Subscribe to The Spectator in our end of lockdown sale and get 10 weeks of the magazine in print and online for the price of one. Not only that, but we'll also send you a bottle of Pimm's worth £25 absolutely free. That's 10 weeks of The Spectator and a bottle of Pimm's, all for just £4.95. Hurry though, this offer ends on Monday, 19th of July. Go to spectator.co.uk/sale.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week, we ask a few of our writers to read their piece from the magazine aloud. On today's episode, Olivia Potts says the reign of shouty chefs might finally be coming to a close. Rory Sutherland says the race for university qualifications has resulted in collective idiocy. And Tanya Gold says lobsters are a danger to themselves. First up, Olivia Potts.
Professional kitchens have always seemed like pressure cookers. Hot, sweaty, stressful. The caricature of a head chef is angry, sweary, unable to keep a lid on his temper. He shouts at underlings for the most minor of infractions. Recent events have shown how pervasive that stereotype still is. A number of ex-employees of The Kitchen Group, the set of restaurants owned by celebrity chef Tom Kitchen, have made allegations of a range of abuse, from being denied food, drink and breaks, to deliberate burning and sexual harassment. Two senior members of staff have been suspended pending investigation. But the response from the food industry has been muted. Many have simply ignored the claims. Others have made excuses. Food critic William Sitwell claimed that, in any high-pressure environment, tensions run high and tempers can fray. To anyone outside of this bubble, this is deranged. These allegations don't describe sharp words. They describe systematic abuse. The problem with kitchens is cultural. In a restaurant, abuse isn't just tolerated. It is aspirational. Arguably, this was baked into the restaurant kitchen from the start. When French chef Auguste Escoffier introduced the brigade system of kitchen hierarchy in the late 19th century, he explicitly modelled it on the army. This brought valuable discipline and order, but also concentrated power in the hands of chefs, untrained for leadership. And the thing is, the kitchen isn't a war zone. This is not Waterloo. It's lunch. The heyday of the rock star chef came in the 1990s with Marc-Pierre White. He became a legend. At the time, the younger chef to have been awarded 3 Michelin stars and the poster child for bad boy chefs. White described his kitchen in his 2007 memoir, The Devil in the Kitchen, as his theatre of cruelty. By his own admission, he shouted, swore, threw food and glass bottles, slashed chefs' whites with knives. Chefs were throttled, hung on hooks by their aprons, or dumped in dustbins. Discipline, he explains, is born out of fear. It's often been reported that, as Gordon Ramsay's mentor, White made the ultimate shouty man cry. But then Ramsay is a good example of this cycle of abuse. He has made his own career out of screaming at chefs on television until they cry. In the intervening years, though, some have engaged in self-reflection. In the 2000s, Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, which details the toxic world of New York restaurants, became something of a Bible for bad boy chefs. Bourdain later wrote that it was not a story about a particularly good or commendable career. It validates a lot of bad behaviour. René Redzepi, co-owner of Noma, voted best restaurant in the world multiple times, has also reflected on his behaviour. I've been a bully for a large part of my career. I've yelled and pushed people. This was how I had been taught to cook, and it was the only way I knew to get a message through. It took a long time for him to realise that people perform better when they're confident rather than fearful. We can't take the boiling points out of service, so we need to find tools to handle them better. What are these tools? Chef's union UNICHEF has started a petition calling for the rescinding of Michelin stars and AA rosettes awarded to restaurants where staff are abused. Asma Khan, chef owner of Darjeeling Express, has backed this. "We are hemorrhaging the future stars of our industry," she tells me, "and most of them are women. Let's talk criminality. Let's talk about sanctions. Let's talk about boycott." Ravneet Gill, a pastry chef and presenter of Junior Bake Off, founded Countertalk, a hospitality recruitment platform committed to only promoting jobs with healthy work environments. Gill says she has seen a shift in employers taking responsibility for the welfare of their staff and warns, "When you shun or blacklist someone, it's like saying you're incapable of change. And if that's true, we're never going to get better." Where companies are failing, she says, there needs to be compassion and the chance for redemption. "I'm sympathetic to both Khan's fury and Gill's bridge building. I think we need both if restaurant culture is to change. But change may already be on the cards. The pandemic has led to huge staff shortages in hospitality. Workers are in demand, which means they have more options than ever. Restaurant staff may decide they do not want to work for abusive chefs anymore. And if owners and investors see these chefs as a liability rather than an asset, the tide is likely to turn rather quickly. Wouldn't that be delicious?"
That was Olivia Potts. And now, Rory Sutherland.
Sometimes the opposite of a good idea is, as Niels Bohr once said, another good idea. But the converse is also true. The opposite of a bad idea can easily be an even worse idea. And something like this seems to have happened with the expansion of British higher education. When I left university in 1988, if you wanted a reasonable first job, a degree from a Russell Group university was probably sufficient but not necessary. Now it seems to be necessary but not sufficient. The result is that a large number of perfectly capable but non-academic people are excluded from having a stab at many jobs where, for all we know, they could be brilliant. But it has also led to the emergence of bizarre and wasteful forms of hyper-competitive behaviour among those who do play the credentials game. And it has become a game. To give one example, when applying to top management consultancies, it is widely known that various text analysis algorithms are used automatically to sift job applications. Now here's the thing, many of the nerdier applicants know this, so they start by composing perfectly sensible applications to email to prospective employers. But before they send them, and I promise I'm not making this up, they type a series of positive adjectives and descriptors, perhaps Nobel laureate, double Olympic medalist, becomes mildly aroused by the sight of a spreadsheet at the bottom of their CV. They then change the font colour of these words to white. This way they're invisible to the human eye, but remain legible to the computer which is making the decision. Now this kind of thing is nuts, but perhaps the consultancies are no less silly in pursuing such an approach to begin with, because it rests on the assumption that the optimal way to build an elite organisation is by assembling a homogeneous group of similarly elite, over-educated, hyper-competitive individuals. It isn't. One MBA in a group might be valuable, whereas 10 is often a formula for groupthink and collective idiocy. Dr. William Muir is an evolutionary biologist at Purdue University. In the 1990s, in a landmark experiment in poultry eugenics, he set out to create super chickens, breeding from only the top-laying single hens in any group. Compared with the control group, the results were a catastrophe. Placed together, these uber chickens produced very few eggs and spent most of the time pecking each other to death. The best solution was not to breed from hens which were most productive individually, but to breed only from the most productive groups. If you're interested in knowing more, there is a TED talk by Margaret Heffernan on this very topic. I was reminded of this finding last week when watching the masterpiece that is Clarkson's Farm. The farm is worked by five of the most incongruous individuals imaginable. It is almost Shakespearean in capturing the breadth of humankind, and the series is unfailingly entertaining as a result. But there are many deeper levels at which you can watch it. For instance, the breakout hero of the series, the tractor driver Caleb Cooper, is the perfect embodiment of tacit knowledge. In Michael Polanyi's phrase, the fact that we know much more than we can tell. Now, Caleb has never heard of Oklahoma or Moses, but in reversing a trailer into a narrow gate, a perfect example of a skill you can acquire but not teach, you would bet on him against any engineering professor on Earth. The amusement value of the series lies in the absurdly different characters it depicts. The deeper lesson which emerges is that this breadth is not a bug but a feature. In the short term, the farm would run better if Caleb or the farm manager Charlie Island were exclusively in control. In the long term, it needs a mix of all of them.
That was Rory Sutherland. And now, Tanya Gold.
Lobsters like to live in gullies on the sea floor or under sand, and I understand how they feel. But you can't hide from politics. An amendment to the Animal Welfare Sentience Bill will make it illegal to post shrink-wrapped lobsters alive or boil them alive, which turns them from blue to Father Christmas scarlet. In Switzerland, Norway and New Zealand, it is already illegal to boil them. It is considered kinder to freeze them or pierce them or shoot them with an expensive lobster stunning gun, which you can probably buy in Hampstead Village, and then boil them. Lobsters were once food for the destitute near the sea, so plentiful they would wash ashore in piles. Then the trains came and it was possible to transport them inland. The price shot up. I think the pleasure is in the oddness, the decadence of eating something so resistant and with so little meat. Lobsters grow a shell each year, but it hasn't helped them so far. In the seafood restaurant I visit, they don't want to boil them alive. They don't want them at all. The lobsters come in flustered and need to sit under damp tea towels so they can't see what's happening. It's taken a long time for people to realise they do feel, says the chef. He pierces their spinal cord with a knife because it's more humane. A waitress here once worked in a restaurant where lobsters were steamed alive. They were placed on racks with trays of water at the bottom. They knocked on the door with their claws, pleading, she says, tap, tap, tap. Or they would shed their claws, like a lobster in a Russian novel. I am glad I have only eaten two, once in a Swiss restaurant with a pretend decadent uncle who couldn't conceal his heartbreak, and once for a newspaper feature. I don't like lobster, and neither does the waitress. They're overrated. People love them because they are expensive. The shellfish merchant thinks the law is ridiculous. All politics is a balance between competing rights, and he cares more about the lobster fishermen than the lobsters because he doesn't drink with the lobsters. He has a PhD in live transport methodology for crustaceans, and he believes if this bill comes in, it's going to be a mess. We will lose diversity in the marketplace. Only the very large wholesalers will be able to transport lobsters in tanks on lorries. The smaller ones will collapse. I asked the lobster fisherman what a lobster's like. He thinks it's a stupid question, but who else would I ask? He has 150 pots, and he checks them once a week, but not in winter. The sea is too rough. He baits the pots with salted fish, and they walk in on 10 legs, oblivious. Not the large ones, who might be 47 years old, like me. The middling ones. Once he got 9 in one pot, but they were small, and he had to throw them back, along with the pregnant, women and children overboard. Fishermen spend a surprising amount of time with tape measures. You can't farm lobsters because they are cannibals, and I like that about them. That is why, delicacy or no, they come wearing rubber bands to protect them from themselves.
That was Tanya Gold, and that's it for this week's episode. Thanks very much for listening to Spectator Out Loud, and don't forget that we've got an end of lockdown flash sale on. You can get 10 weeks of the magazine, in print and online, and a free bottle of Pimm's, all for just £4.95. That's 10 issues for the price of one and a free bottle of Pimm's. Go to spectator.co.uk/sale to take it up. Hurry, the offer ends on Monday. Thanks again for listening and join us again next week.